listening to One to One with Paul Costello, a podcast from the Stanford School of Medicine.
More than a year ago, neurosurgeon Paul Kalanithi wrote a searing column in the New York Times entitled, "How Long Have I Got Left?" There he describes his battle with lung cancer and how he is facing his own mortality. 37 years old and the father of a young child, everything in his life should be sunny, but it's not. He was just finishing his residency in neurosurgery when he was diagnosed. He knows there is no cure. Treatments will only prolong his life, and for that he's grateful. Now recovering from a particularly grueling treatment regime from last spring that brought setbacks and complications, he's hopeful that he'll soon return to neurosurgery. Yet he is still preparing for the inevitable. He's spoken with a palliative care expert while mulling existential questions and trying to face questions of moving on while not giving up. He takes comfort in the words of the Irish novelist and playwright Samuel Beckett, "I can't go on, I can go on." They become sort of his mantra. This podcast is a companion to a beautiful piece he's written for Stanford Medicine magazine. To be sure, no matter what his health status, he will live on. Paul Kalanithi, thank you for joining me on One to One. You know, I was driving over here thinking, how do I start a conversation with someone who has a terminal illness and is facing a very difficult future? And it's probably one of the most painful, deep, existential conversations I've had in a long time. And I'm, you know, you were just talking before we really began this conversation about the use of verbs. And even the simple things about I am, I will be, I am a neurosurgeon, the complication of facing the end, having a terminal illness, can you talk about that? And can you talk about specifically what you said to me a moment ago, which is about just the use of verbs?
Sure. You know, having a terminal illness is a challenge to your sense of time and your sense of identity, and as we were just talking, someone asked me, you know, what I do for a living. I often don't know exactly what to say. Do I say I am a neurosurgeon, I was a neurosurgeon, or I will be a neurosurgeon again? And it's often hard to know which is the most true of those statements.
How do you deal with the notion of time? And when you look at time and you look at, you know, we all know that we have a finite period of time here, but your time is that much more tighter, presumably. How do you think of time and the future and what you have and what you don't have? And when you hear also people say next year, next week, next month, What does that bring up? Does that bring up a sense of what are the feelings that go along with that?
It really varies on the situation. I just had my 15th Stanford reunion, someone was like, "Well, you know, it'll be really interesting to see how the 30th is." And I was like, "Well, it might be interesting for you, but I, you know, don't think I'll be there for it." Sometimes that's sad. Sometimes it's just kind of a matter of fact. It varies a bit just on how I'm feeling, I guess. I mean, you know, if I think about, you know, not seeing my daughter grow up, then, you know, that's obviously, you know, kind of heart-wrenching. But, as you said, we all know our time is finite. And in some ways, when people say, you know, "See you at the 30th reunion," I'm like, it sounds like, "Well, see you at the 100th, 125th class reunion." I'm just like, well, no, that's just not a logical possibility. And it's not any more disturbing than that.
What is the state of your health? What is your current condition?
It's always a great question. I mean, I am, I guess, on my second line of therapy now. I was diagnosed in May of 2013 and took a pill that targeted the mutation for my cancer, which then mutated again after about a year, and so I had to do chemotherapy. And so I did about 3 months of chemotherapy, which just kind of finished at the sort of early part of the summer. And I'm kind of recuperating from that now. The chemotherapy had a lot of complications. And so now we're in what's called maintenance period. And we see how long that lasts. And when the cancer starts growing again, then you have to look for another form of therapy.
But there's no possibility for a cure?
No. I mean, no realistic possibility. I mean, you look at some of the studies and, you know, they'll have like one person have a complete remission on, you know, treatment X, but it's not a likely possibility. It's certainly something I don't consider a real possibility.
So take me back to the day you were diagnosed and perhaps a bit before that. What were the symptoms of your illness when you first went to a physician for a diagnosis? And you yourself are a physician. So what was that? What were the days before that like, and what was the day like?
Sure. So it also was kind of a process. I've been losing a little bit of weight, but that's not uncommon for neurosurgery residents because you're working really hard and really busy and not, you know, eating frequently. Like when I started residency as an intern, I think I lost 15 or 20 pounds. And so I had a similar weight loss and some back pain. And just kind of as a precautionary measure, had some x-rays taken of my back because, you know, it seemed very unlikely, but it's possible there, you know, it could be cancer, but, you know, more likely the back pain would be due to something called isthmic spondylolisthesis. It doesn't really matter. Some back problem. And all that looked normal. And then, so I carried on for a few more months, treating my back pain with ibuprofen. And then I developed what are called the B symptoms, the classic symptoms of cancer, which are fevers and night sweats. And then I dropped kind of all of a sudden an additional 15 pounds. And so then I knew, and this is again in May of 2013, you know, at that point, you know, the diagnosis is clear. Either I have, you know, tuberculosis or cancer. And then I developed a cough. You know, before that, like in the week before I developed the cough, you know, I started looking at all the most common cancers in 30-year-olds. And, you know, testicular didn't have that. I went to see a dermatologist to look for any funny skin spots for melanoma. I didn't have anything unusual. Then I developed a cough and then had a chest x-ray taken. And, you know, that showed that my lungs were just covered in tumors. So had myself admitted to the hospital and then had a CT scan. And that kind of revealed the full extent of the disease, which was not just in my lungs, but also my spine and pelvis and liver. And, you know, it's one of the things about being a physician is you get some of these moments in an unmediated way where, you know, typically the part of the role of the physician is to deliver bad news or good news or whatever kind of news. The art of it is the way you deliver that news. But when you're a physician yourself and you're looking at the images yourself, there is no mediation. So I just saw, you know, all of the tumors. On one hand, it was a confirmation of what I suspected, but even so, it was it was crushing. I was in the hospital room with my wife, and it was a feeling as if well, not as if it, it really is that your whole projected future kind of disappears, and you're suddenly living a whole new life than the one you were 10 minutes before.
And the diagnosis was lung cancer initially, and you've never smoked a day in your life.
Correct. So 17% or roughly 1 in 5 people with lung cancer have never smoked. And if you count people who quit smoking years before, the number goes up to like 60%. But I actually didn't know that before I was diagnosed. I was shocked that I had lung cancer, because again, right, I've never smoked, so how could I get lung cancer?
When you see people who smoke now, do you feel particularly angry at them, or that they are why me versus, seeing someone smoke? I used to smoke, and when I see people smoke today, I want to scream at them. I want to yell at them. What do you think?
I kind of have that. Reaction is, why would you possibly do that? I never really had the why me sort of question, just because working in neurosurgery, you just see terrible things happen for no reason all the time. It's funny that, before I had lung cancer, even though I'd never smoked, before I had lung cancer, I sort of felt a little bit of sympathy for smokers, in the sense that they have become sort of our generation's public crusade against smoking. And now that I have lung cancer, it's hard for me to look at a smoker, I just think, gosh, if only you knew what you're, signing yourself up for.
What the possibility and potential is. Your voice is gravelly, I've noticed. Is that a byproduct? Is that a symptom of the illness?
Yeah, mostly. My voice has changed actually a fair amount during the course of the illness. There was a while when my voice became very, very faint for a couple months, and it has just been one of the many little aspects of disease that, as a doctor, you certainly never think about, but as a patient, you face all the time.
In the New York Times article that you wrote, a quote from the Irish novelist and playwright Samuel Beckett has become sort of a mantra for you, or was a mantra at one point, and it was, "I can't go on, I can go on." Why did that have such deep meaning for you? How did it resonate?
Well, it really helped me through that sort of, I guess, difficult initial confrontation with my own mortality, in that, you reach this point where you're very aware that you're going to die, and I'm very aware that at some point in the next few years, I will almost certainly die of lung cancer. But, you know, a few years is still a long time. And so there becomes this question of what to do with that time. And, you know, on one hand, when we're used to thinking, and I was used to thinking, and had actually plotted out, you know, roughly a 40-year career for myself, it seems like nothing is worth doing. Yet you still wake up every day and have to, you know, figure out what to do with that day. And so for me, it really captured kind of the I don't know exactly what the word is. I always want to say that sort of like the Janus face of the illness, is that on one hand, you know, we're mortal and we're going to die, and you know, even if you're Ozymandias, you die, and if you build an empire, it crumbles. You know, so what's the point of doing anything? But at the same time, you know, we're human. We do things. We build value and meaning. And so you continue on doing those things. And, you know, I think Beckett is sort of interesting for that reason, because I think he was someone who was very aware of mortality and, you know, aware of the contradiction that it poses for being alive. And I think most of us, you know, can happily ignore the force of that. But when you're faced with terminal illness, you can't, and you have to feel the weight of mortality and yet still find some way to have a meaningful life.
You know, you mentioned the you use the term meaningful life, and my brother died very young, 48 years old, father of two. And I think back at the conversations we had before he passed away. And they were really about, is my life meaningful? Do I have meaning? And it was so primal to have someone pose that. You know, does my life have meaning? And that we all face that in a certain way, but you certainly face it much more acutely when your time is being robbed, especially. And is that sort of, how are you trying to traverse that? How are you trying to ensure that in 2, 5, whatever years, if you do pass away, that you will be able to say, which I think is a very primal question, yes, my life did have meaning?
You know, that's a question that I've thought about my whole life. You know, even as a, you know, a very young man, I was really focused on how one lives a meaningful life. And you know, at some point in my early 20s or so, I sort of concluded that it's your kind of contribution to some larger narrative in the world that that matters. And so I kind of built my life around making that contribution over the course of a lifetime. And, you know, the particularities of my life were going to be as a, you know, a neurosurgeon and neuroscientist, you know, working towards understanding the brain and developing treatments for diseases that we can't treat currently, you know, as well as the day-to-day of caring for patients and helping them find the meanings in the tragedies they were facing. And, you know, I remember my younger brother, when I was diagnosed, you know, sat in my hospital bed and and said, you know, you've accomplished so much. And that felt really hollow to me, because I felt like I was on the cusp of, you know, getting to the point of where I could really start making contributions. And that's kind of what was the most, hurtful part of the diagnosis, was that feeling, I think as you phrased nicely, of being robbed of all this time where I was planning on making my sort of contribution.
And especially because we all look ahead. You know, we look ahead. If we have children, you have a child, I have two daughters, my brother had two daughters. You look ahead at the milestones of life, because they're so, you know, graduation from grade school, from high school, from, you know, college, going to their wedding, speaking at, and the painful thoughts of not of that being taken away from you. And that, I think, is one of the most searing issues about facing death early on, is what the vacuum is going to be, not only for you, but for them.
Absolutely. And I think, in a way, mostly for them. I'm less worried about my death, qua my death, because I'll be dead. But when I think about, the absence that causes for my wife, my family, my daughter, that's what's truly crushing. And it, as far as trying to get back to your question about how do you make meaning in these new circumstances. I think for everyone the answer will be different, and for everyone, I think the answer is constantly changing over the period of illness. For me, initially, it was to get back on the track that I was on, and just go as far as I could.
And the track, you're being a neurosurgeon,
right,
and neuro research, so you're back on that track.
I was, and then I relapsed and had to do chemotherapy, and so my energy levels are much lower than they used to be, and right now are not really commensurable with being a neurosurgeon. So it's again sort of having to readjust and reassess what your life is going to be about, and so part of it right now is really, besides being a new father, is focused on writing. In fact, if you'd asked me if when I was a 16-year-old what I'd do with my life, I was certain I would be a writer, and the New York Times piece, which was, almost an accidental publication, was a nice moment for me personally, in that it got a tremendous response from, thousands of people. I still get an email about it probably every day or every other day. And having that impact through writing was, in a way, redemptive for me. And so if that's something I can do for the remainder of my time, then all the better. Because you can lift a pen a lot longer than you can lift a scalpel.
What do you want to tell the medical community? What do you have a specific message to the medical community and healthcare workers?
I would say it's probably twofold, but only one basic message, that you know, our jobs as physicians is not just to lay out the medical facts as if you were presenting, you know, two different models, a dryer to a consumer, because illness is a transformative experience for a patient. And part of the job of a physician is to, you know, play the role of an emotional shepherd, maybe too strong, but a guide in the sense you should, you know, be able to point out the emotional and experiential landmarks of the new terrain that the patient will find him or herself in, and to really key in on that kind of what you hinted earlier at, that on the process of making meaning in your life. You know, I think that's a role physicians are not, well, you know, at one time maybe we're used to playing, but now the profession is, you know, much more focused on, you know.
The economic pressures?
The economics, for sure, the measurable, countable aspects of the profession, whether that's in, you know, quality scores or you know, financial productivity measurements, and you know, something that really troubles me is you know, what I saw in my medical school classmates was this sort of increasing emphasis on, you know, lifestyle and the meaning, you know, how many hours a week, how few hours a week can I work and make X amount of money? And while, you know, that's, in one sense, very reasonable, because I think that's what most people think about when they think about a job is, you know, their time and their money. You know, to be a physician is a higher calling, and you know, the focus should really be on how to serve your patients.
I'm wondering if as you just spoke, I'm wondering if part of the converse of this illness, this terminal illness, is that you've almost been handed a gift too, that you can look at this from 35,000 feet. You can look at life from 35,000 feet. A friend of mine was told 6 months ago she had 6-7 years to live, which I thought was sort of odd. Why did you choose 6-7 years? Why not 4? Why not 8? You know, it was sort of a strange thing to tell somebody. And I said to her, think of that as a gift in many ways. My sister died a year ago after falling down the stairs, leaving a building in New York City. She had no idea. She was in great health. She had no idea that her day was going to begin and end like that. And if you have something that you have, as horrible as it is, that in some ways you're handed something to really live life, and others of us walk along and don't really seize the moment. You know, I remember the powerful line from the play, Thornton Wilder play, Our Town, do any human beings really realize life while they live it every minute? And that sort of enables you to do that in some respects. Do you feel that?
Not exactly. I mean, I mean, I get the sense of what you're saying, and I think the spirit of it is true, and that everyone should be thinking about what it means to live a meaningful life, and it's a, you know, it's a kind of a minor tragedy that people don't. You know, if you're blessed enough to have gotten, you know, a university education, you've had, you know, hopefully enough luck that you've been able to dictate to some degree what your life is about, that you can understand your life as kind of a linear summation of your choices. And I think, you know, many people, you know, perhaps, I don't, I guess I can't speak on behalf of many people, but, well, you know, that there's a sense that people are, right, that are too focused on things like money or superficial accoutrement of success, and not on what is you know, the essentials of making your life meaningful. But for me, you know, personally, you know, that was always my focus. And so, you know, I don't really view my values any differently. Because really I'd thought a lot about them before I got sick, and found that, you know, they were more or less the same afterwards. And so, the you know, there wasn't that moment of, you know, transvaluation of seeing things, of what mm-hmm. this is what really matters, mm-hmm. kind of mm-hmm. moment.
You've always had that in your scope, putting.
Yeah,
that's always been a value for you.
Yeah, in a way, it was reassuring that you know, looking back on my life, you know, knowing the things that I knew at each moment, I would make the same decisions because, you know, those were the values I was living by.
You had, I don't know where you wrote this, but perhaps it was in the New York Times piece. I don't remember your message. Stop skipping dessert. It's sort of a philosophical approach to how to look at life.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't recommend that for everybody.
Right.
But, I mean, that's, you know, one of the you know, the funny things about knowing your time is short is some of these long-term things, you know, don't matter. You know, I actually, as a joke, asked my oncologist if I could start smoking now. and it turns out the answer is no. Smoking is still bad for you, and still, you know, still increases your likelihood of having a worse cancer outcome, because it's just so bad.
Mm-hmm.
But there, you know, there's certainly a, you know, a sense to which I've reduced my life to the things that I find are sort of most essential. And you know, there are many things that I just don't really need to make time for, and that's kind of a blessing.
You've begun a conversation, I've heard you say publicly, with a palliative care expert, and I think you may have had one session so far. What is that conversation like, and where will that conversation take you? And if you could give a little background of palliative care.
Sure. So palliative care is a branch of medicine. Well, really, it's you know, very simply defined as the treatment of symptoms, and it actually is probably the heart of medicine since its inception. The reason why it became a sort of a separate branch is that in oncology or any area where life expectancy is shortened, there becomes a question of how much you want to treat the symptoms versus how much you want to treat the disease itself. Because certainly, cancer treatment, well, chemotherapy at least, while for some people it can go smoothly, for me it didn't. I was in and out of the hospital and miserable. And that was a treatment of the disease, but it vastly reduced my quality of life for that time. And then, afterwards, it made it better. But when your time is limited, it becomes harder to know how much suffering you take up front for, X chance of improved quality of life later. And so the palliative care movement was sort of generated to say, let's focus on quality of life right now. And not keep treating the disease past a point at which it stopped making sense. There's some statistic that, some large percent of people get chemotherapy in the last 2 weeks of their life. That's probably not doing anything but making them miserable. There was a nice study of palliative care out of Harvard in 2010, showing that the patients who entered palliative care early not only had higher quality of life, but actually ended up living but a couple months longer. While all medicine, again, is in some way palliative care, it's especially important to think about as you approach the end of your life, because while it's the disease that ends your life, it's the symptoms that cause the suffering. And so the conversation I had with Tim Quill was, something similar to this kind of conversation, which is, really about setting the priorities for your life and the how you find what's meaningful to you and how you pursue that meaning and how you can best do that in whatever time and health you have.
Are you still pursuing a path of treatment?
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still on maintenance chemotherapy and that is, working fine for now. Because lung cancer is the most common and most fatal of cancers, there's a long list of treatments. There's been kind of a boom in lung cancer therapy in the last, 10 years or so of, fairly exciting developments. As long as there are treatments that seem to make sense and my health is, reasonable enough to pursue them, I'll pursue them.
What is it like to balance hope versus reality of, or the possibility of that hope being extinguished? How do you balance hope versus, you know, no chance? How do you keep, that must be a very tough thing to, you know, keep in check, is to not have the hope overwhelm parts of the reality that you have a terminal illness. How do you juggle that?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I don't know that I know the answer. I think that's one of the probably the most difficult jobs for both the doctor and the patient, is to find that kind of band of optimism that's not so optimistic that it's unrealistic, but is not so pessimistic that it's you know, actually crushing the meaning out of your life as you're living it. You know, part of it, I think, is sort of taking things day by day, which is kind of the only way I can take them right now. You know, setting small goals for myself, finding things that I can and want to do that are, you know, exciting to me and seem worthwhile projects. And then on top of that, you know, planning out longer term things with the, you know, the full knowledge that, you know, I may never get to them. And so, you know, kind of having a plan for a better case scenario, and then kind of in the short term, finding those little chunks of activity that are sort of renewing and exciting. Whether that is, you know, for me personally, that just because of who I am, it, you know, reading novels, and poetry, writing. I'll probably get back into doing a little bit of science and hopefully some teaching. So I'm still kind of working out, you know, what my days will entail, and if my health picks up for a while, then, you know, get back into actually performing surgery again. And if it doesn't, then it doesn't.
Paul Kalanithi, thank you for joining me at 1:1.
My pleasure.
The preceding program is copyrighted by the Board of Trustees of Stanford University. 1:1 is produced by the School of Medicine's Office of Communication and Public Affairs. For more information, please visit us at mednews.stanford.edu.